everybody, and welcome to the Sauce Perspective. And hey, Trevor, I have something that I really need to say to you. Are you ready for it?
Okay.
You're not even in my top 10.
Wait, what? I'm lost here. I am not making any connections in my head about what you just said.
You've apparently forgotten one of my favorite unintentionally hilarious lines from the movie that we're talking about today.
Oh my god, okay. It's like, it's just like, Trevor, kind of thrown out there at towards the beginning of this movie that I just totally didn't think anything about. Okay.
Okay, so before, between my dad and my sister and I, we're all kind of pop culture obsessed, and Trevor, you've experienced this firsthand.
Oh my god, it's...
But...
With you and your sister in a car for 5 hours, they just tried to, tape you both your mouths shut and then, like, put a bag over your head and make sure you couldn't experience anything.
That's really violent. That hurts my feelings
violent.
Deep.
There's no violence involved in that process.
On a deep personal level, I am offended. I'm going to cry myself to sleep tonight.
Well, you just said I wasn't in your top 10, Don.
So, between my dad and my sister and I, we're all kind of pop culture obsessed, and we use pop culture quotes or references as kind of a shorthand for things. And, like, if I ever say something, like, and so my dad was the person who introduced our Digging Deep film to me this week. He likes it a lot, which is weird. But anytime I do something that upsets him, he'll fake yell, "You're not even in my top 10 at me. So that, like, my sister, who hasn't even seen the film, will also say that, because just like that, because at the moment's so ridiculous, that quote is part of the sort of inside jokes, secret language of the West Virginia sauce household.
So you're saying your family has your own idioms?
We do have our own idioms. if one of us says no to a question that the other person wishes that we would say yes to, we always say, "It'd be a lot cooler if you did." We always quote Dazed and Confused. It's how we communicate with each other. It's probably not healthy. There's probably something wrong with us. Something just deeply, innately wrong with us as people. But that's how we function. And on that note, Trevor, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit how the Sauce Perspective is laid out?
Well, we break the podcast into three segments. The first segment, called Digging Deep, is where Don suggests a movie to watch. I got him to watch it. And most of the time, this movie is considered to be unappreciated and potentially unknown. The second segment, this week's Sauce Sauce, is where Don and I discuss something new, which could be movies, TV, video games, world events, something new that has caught our attention, we're going to be talking about it. And the last segment, the Secret Sauce, is where Don and I also just basically ramble about other things that are happening in our lives. So, what is on the discussion board today, Don?
Well, this week is the fourth week of our films starring actors and actresses before they were famous. And I'm also going to say that this is a week where it's also a director before he was famous. We are talking about 2003's All the Real Girls from director David Gordon Green, who is most famous for the stoner classic Pineapple Express. I've seen both of these films a decent number of times, and it's so hard for me to reconcile those two facts that the same person wrote and directed both of them. We'll be talking, but the real reason we're talking about it is because this is the earliest thing that I can remember seeing Zooey Deschanel in, beyond perhaps an episode of Frasier. For this week's Hot Sauce, we're going to be talking about the excellent last two episodes of Better Call Saul, a show that keeps being better than I would have ever hoped it would have been, which is really reassuring, because Trevor and I desperately needed a TV show to talk about. And lastly, for the Secret Sauce, Trevor is going to talk about his new 3DS XL, as opposed to the original 3DSs, and I might talk a little bit about BioWare's latest RPG epic, Dragon Age Inquisition. And on that note, Trevor, we're going to jump right into the... I almost said the secret sauce, and we're not doing things in reverse. This is not the Memento episode of the sauce perspective, although that would be interesting if we did everything backwards. We would have to plan that out ahead of
time. I don't think we would ever get to our final topic.
I don't think we would either.
Because we saw the secret sauce. It would just be the secret sauce for an hour.
We could literally just talk. We could talk about, oh, fuck, I don't know. Hey, like the fact that WVU beat Texas. In basketball, WVU's men's team is ranked number 20 in the country. I'm pretty happy about that. It's a real turnaround from not making the NIT tournament last year.
Yeah.
So we're going to jump right into Digging Deep. And before I tell everybody what the film is about, Trevor, did you enjoy All the Real Girls?
I'm not particularly sold on this film. I was kind of let down, because usually these random indie films you occasionally will pop on me are usually pretty good, but this one, no love for it.
Okay,
no. At the end of the day, so.
That's fair. I think this movie's a tougher sell than most of the indie films that we've like Beginners or Liberal Arts or Conversations with Other Women. This one is. I'm not gonna say that it's more complex. It's constructed a lot different. Excuse me. It's constructed a lot differently than them. Like, this one is very, I don't know how to say it, mosaic in its construction. There's a lot of jumping around without necessarily a cohesive narrative tying it all together. And that tends to be the films that you don't like. You like a tight narrative for the most part, I've noticed anyways. With some exceptions. Like, you enjoyed Beginners, and I think it's pretty freeform.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm still really glad that you liked Beginners, by the way. Well, I mean, the thing about All the Real Girls, too, is that Beginners and The Station Agent and Liberal Arts, they're ultimately kind of uplifting films, and All the Real Girls is kind of really dark and cynical and pessimistic. So, on that note, I'll tell everybody what it's about. So, All the Real Girls, like I said, it stars Zooey Deschanel, although she's a supporting star in the film more than anything else. And actually, she's not the only star in this before anybody knew who they were. Danny McBride, who is Red in Pineapple Express, also has a pretty big role in this, as well as Parks and Recreation's Paul Schneider, who was also in the Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford.
Yep.
Paul Schneider and Danny McBride and the guy who directed the film, David Gordon Green, they all went to film school together, and so they've all been very, very tight with one another since then. Little random factoid. So, All the Real Girls is about a young man named Paul, played by Paul Schneider, living in a small town in rural North Carolina, and he is a womanizer who has slept with and hurt, not physically, but emotionally hurt, basically every eligible woman in his town. But then one summer, the younger sister of his best friend comes back from boarding school. This would be the summer before she goes off to college, although she doesn't end up going off to college. She comes back. A woman, and he falls in love with his best friend's sister, and he wants to not treat her the way that he treated all of the other girls that he's mistreated and kind of, not, I don't want to say abused, but certainly exploited to an extent. But in the end, Paul finds out that it's much more, and that girl's Zooey Deschanel, her name's Noel in the film. But by the end, Paul discovers that he's simply traded in one type of objectification in for another. And so, Trev, I guess I'll lead with this question. What was it that you found disappointing about the film?
There's nothing, I don't know. I didn't feel it, you know? Sometimes some movies just some movies speak to you and sometimes they don't, and this one just didn't speak to me.
No, that's fair.
Because it didn't speak to me, it didn't really stand out to me. Nothing was particularly special about this. I actually thought Zooey Deschanel was okay in this movie. I thought Paul, the main lead, was the best of the whole movie.
No, Paul Schneider is a very good job. Zooey Deschanel is okay. She has one scene where she's really allowed to kind of...
Yeah, the cheating scene.
The what scene?
The scene where she's admitting her guilt.
Yeah, that scene. That's the one where she's really able to let loose and be a really sort of three-dimensional character.
Yeah.
The Noel character is kind of flat, but intentionally so, because she's supposed to be a reflection. Up until that point, she's supposed to be a reflection of this idealized girl that Paul sees in her. But then from that point forward, she suddenly becomes a real person, and Paul isn't able to process that. But you're right, that scene, she's really able to do something. And then also, there's a scene a little bit earlier where she's talking about when she cut herself with a fishing hook as a child.
Yeah.
But Zooey Deschanel, it's not that she does a bad job, although her southern accent is hilariously bad. It's not good. I love you, Zooey Deschanel, but... You are so obviously from the Pacific Northwest, it hurts. But yeah, no, Paul Schneider does it. It's a weird good performance. It's not a conventionally good performance. It's strange. But okay, well, we'll keep. What are some more thoughts you have?
The story itself was okay as well. I'm not particularly why. Well, your dad has weird taste in movies, so I'm not gonna try to argue anything against your dad about the movies. He doesn't have any consistency at all, does he?
No, he does not have any consistency whatsoever. Where do you think I get my complete inconsistency from?
Yeah, the story was okay. Like, for me, there wasn't much. I'm trying to improve how I critique things. I don't want to say nothing happened again, because things did happen.
Correct.
But the things that did happen didn't have, I don't know, much impact on how I was feeling in the movie or how I was interpreting things. Because I'm like, these are just typical people. They're late teens dealing with, well, one's late teen. I don't know how old Paul is. I don't think they ever told his age.
I think at one point they said that Danny McBride was 22.
Okay.
So I would say that they're in their early 20s. 22, okay. 23, something like that.
So that's okay. So I can at least understand now some of his transitional mindset about what he wants in life. You know, I'm 26 and I still feel some ways about that.
I'll be 26 in 2 days. So,
man, dude,
yeah. We're getting old.
Yeah.
I wrote an article for Babel yesterday. It got published today. I don't know if you had a chance to read it or not.
I did. I always, every time you post something you write, I read it.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm not going to say what I'm going to say because I'll talk about that next week. But that. At one point in that article, I mentioned listening to CDs on a Sony Discman on my ride to school. And try explaining a fucking Discman to a 10-year-old today.
True.
So, like, okay, Trevor. So the point that I was making was about, like, how far things have come in 12 years. Because that was 2003 or whatever. And, So, you know, 12 years ago, I think iPods maybe were just coming out. I don't think they came
MP3
out until 2004.
MP3 players were becoming a thing at that point. I think, like, the original
right,
iPod
MP3 players were just becoming a thing. And I think the first iPod came out in 2004 or 5. I got mine in 2006, and I think Ryan Schubert had one before anybody else did at Philip Barber. I think he was, like, the first of us to have an iPod.
Yeah, because I remember he didn't have the wheel, the touch wheel.
Right, he did not have a wheel.
It was a wheel, but it wasn't a touch wheel.
No, it was like a weird, funky, like analog wheel.
It was analog wheel, and there was analog buttons too on the above of the wheel.
Yep. So, just think about how much things have changed since then. We have, you know, we have Spotify. We have iPhones. We have the ability to, you know, pay $10 a month to have a Spotify subscription and then have access to basically the entirety of modern music on our phone, even if we're not connected to the internet, if we download it, because a Spotify has an offline mode if you have the space on whatever device you're using.
Mm-hmm.
So that would have seemed inconceivable to me 12 years ago. What's it going to be like in 2027?
We have chips in our brain, and we can just, like...
Yeah, basically, that's what that's the only thing I can think of.
I don't know.
We'll be able to listen to music psychically at that point, which is just fucking cyberpunk shit.
That'd be a terrible idea, though, because I don't think I could shut it off.
So, that's... We got really distracted there.
About the storyline and everything else. I don't know. I just wasn't feeling this movie, and it's hard to explain that because it's more of a personal emotional connection thing. Like, I can't say the movie was typically bad because it wasn't bad, but it wasn't just it
right.
Was,
so
wasn't selling it.
You just didn't connect to it, and that's totally understandable. That happens. Yeah. So here's the thing that I'm going to say. I'm not going to say that All the Real Girls is a great film because it isn't.
No,
I think
not
it has.
But it's not a bad film. That's the thing. It's not a bad
no,
film.
No, I mean, I enjoy it a lot. I think it's a really good film. I actually think that there are some really kind of a lot of areas where it misses, it makes mistakes, misses its cues, so to speak. I think the dialogue in the film can be really bad sometimes.
Yeah.
Characters will go from like one of the whole points of the film is that these people don't know who they are, and the kind of the tragedy that arrives when grown men refuse to grow up. Like, I mean, I'll talk about that more in detail in a second. That to me, that it's a film about the tragedy of masculine immaturity. And also objectification of women to an extent. But one of the subsets of that, you know, idea of masculine immaturity is that these are all characters who don't know who they are, who don't know where they're going in life, don't really have any sort of direction. And, you know, mostly they can't, like, articulate. They can't even articulate what they're trying to say. And so they speak in sort of these silly half sentences that they try to pass off as depth when they're really just covering up how unsure they are. But then every now and then a character will give what I like to call the silent Bob monologue, which is when somebody says something that too succinctly sums up the point of whatever you're watching. And that happens, like, on multiple occasions in the film. Like, they might as well have the people, like, turn directly to the camera and say, here are the themes of our movie. And that's problematic. On the one hand, I get why it happened. Let me get on Wikipedia real quick. Or not Wikipedia, IMDb. I mean, Wikipedia would have also done the trick, I suppose. But David Gordon Green was super young when he made this film. Yeah, he was 28. So it was a work of a very young filmmaker. I'm not going to say that, you know, it was a work of a filmmaker so young that it excuses that, because I mean I would hope that I mean although I'm guilty of it too in my own writing to an extent. But I get it. It's a young filmmaker making a film about young people. I understand what's going on. He's now 40 years old. Holy shit. Man, this movie is 12 years old. It's weird that we were just talking about things that happened 12 years ago, and we're talking about a film that's 12 years old now. We were 15 when this movie... Not 15. We were 14 when this movie came out. Which it feels like a lifetime ago to me, to be honest.
It is.
Well, I mean, let's be fair. 12 years ago was almost half of our life. A little less. a year less than half of our life.
Indeed. Indeed.
How terrifying is that thought?
It's terrifying, but luckily, like, majority of our life's still to come, and we're still younger than most of the world. I've had a stat about that. Like, I think in the U.S., once you reach, like, halfway through your 30th year, you're, like, older than most of the U.S. So we got a few more years to be young.
Oh, God, that's the most depressing thing you've ever told me.
Well, it's even worse for the world. Like, if you're, like, 28, you're, like, older than most of the world.
Right. So, in terms of, like, the dialogue, I think the film's kind of really messy and really rough. But the film has something going for it that I always find really endearing in movies, and that it's a painfully sincere film. I've gotten to this point in my life where I don't have any patience for irony anymore. You can be funny and still be sincere. You know, you can tell jokes without creating this stupid distance between yourself and the world. And I mean, All the Real Girls isn't a comedy; it's a drama. There are funny moments in it, but it is explicitly a drama. But this film is really aware of how little most guys ultimately know about women, and it's really aware of the price that men pay because of how little so many of us understand about women, but also the damage that we do to women because we understand so little about them. So the film is way too on the nose in the way that characters address these issues, but in the act of storytelling itself, I think it has a really mature and complicated understanding of masculinity and growing up, and objectification in ways that you don't really see too often. Like, Paul spent his entire life objectifying all of the women in his town as sex objects, because that was just the only thing he knew how to do. And then, finally, he meets this girl that he wants to have something more than that with, but rather than viewing her as a real person, he instead views her as something beyond a girl. She kind of ceased being a girl to him. She became just another kind of object. But instead of an object that he wanted to fuck, it was an object that he wanted to cherish in other ways, rather than, you know, understanding that, hey, maybe she too wants to fuck. Maybe if they had had sex, she wouldn't have cheated on him with the guy. Spoiler alert, I guess. She wouldn't have cheated on him with the guy at the beach. The beach house or wherever she went for that weekend. You know, if he had understood that she was a human being with her own needs and her own flaws, maybe he could have understood why. I'm not excusing infidelity, but maybe he could have understood better why it is that she did what she did. And there's this whole recurring theme throughout the film that men don't treat women the right way because they just refuse to grow up, and they refuse to grow up because we've created these social structures, particularly in impoverished areas where there's not a lot of education and where there's not a lot of, you know, job opportunity. We create these social structures that essentially allow men to be children up till and even past, you know, when they have kids of their own. And so, you know, you always see Paul riding a bike. You always see them playing childish games and engaging in kind of childish discussions. And we live in an era where most of the big mainstream comedies are about, like, really immature guys who don't, like, you know, basically the premise of every Will Ferrell or Adam Sandler or, you know, like, Paul Rudd movie is about a guy that refuses to grow up and it's played for laughs, and they're, like, made to be the hero, be like, for their rebellious refusal to, you know, fucking stop being a kid. And all the real girls, one of the things I really love about it is that it's like, no, that's, you know, that's not okay. The fun and games have to end someday. Or, you know, if the fun and games don't have to end, at least you need to have responsibility to the other people around you. Because Paul is a self-centered asshole in a lot of ways. He, you know, forgets to take his mother, who is kind of the polar opposite. I mean, well, she's also kind of a child in a lot of ways. But, you know, he leaves her hanging when she needs to get to the children's hospital where she works as a clown. And the film is, at least thematically to me, a really interesting examination of that kind of pathological male immaturity. And I guess I am kind of interested in movies that examine the shittier parts of the ways that we are socialized as men, because it teaches important lessons to us about, hey, you know better than to be this way. Perhaps, I'm not sure. And on that note, we're going to stop talking about all the real girls. We're going to just go ahead and move right on to Digging Deep. And Trevor.
Yo.
I'm not digging deep. This week's hot sauce.
Yeah, you
I'm going to continue to let you take the lead.
All the time. You mix these things.
Huh?
You mix up the segments all the time.
I do mix up the segments all the time, and I don't know why, but I definitely do.
So you want me to take lead on this segment again? This is like the fifth straight week, man. I feel like it's like every week now.
Hey, well, maybe that's a new thing. You are definitely more of the TV guy than me.
True that. I do watch this three TV shows I am currently watching on the regular right now. So,
The Americans, Better Call Saul, and Togetherness?
No, The Walking Dead.
Oh, The Walking Dead. Okay.
Yeah, I've never watched Togetherness, so I have no idea if I would enjoy it or not. First off, there's way too much television. That's a problem. But
there is so much TV. I thought there was too much TV when I was in high school, and that was before the ascendancy of basic cable becoming the new TV powerhouse in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely has. The only competition that basic cable has for that title is HBO. Sure as shit isn't fucking Stars or Showtime.
But nevertheless, let's get back to Jimmy.
Oh, Jimmy.
So we're two episodes this time, right? Episode 3 and 4.
Yep.
So
Hero and something else.
Oh, I don't know the names. I don't know what happens. Okay, so the third episode, we got left off with the proposal from Nacho to Jimmy about getting information about where the family is hiding all their embezzled money. And what happens is Jimmy has this episode examines, I think, what Jimmy was and what he is and what he's becoming all in one. Because you got the flashback at the beginning with his brother.
Yeah, where we finally get confirmation that he's his brother.
Yeah.
Confirmation on the show, anyways.
Yeah. About doing some, I don't know what he did. They didn't explain what he did, I don't think.
Wait, what?
In the flashback, why he's in jail?
What about it?
They don't know. They never explain why he's in jail.
Yeah, something bad.
Yeah, he did something bad, and he's going to be potentially charged as a sex criminal for, I guess, I don't know what he was doing. He said the
phrase "Chicago sunroof," and I have no idea what that is.
I have no idea either. But that's the first time we see Jimmy not being this pathetic lawyer that's trying to do good. We see a naughty side of Jimmy, which is fascinating to me. I'm kind of curious to know what he was before he became a lawyer.
Well, do you want to know what Urban Dictionary says a Chicago sunroof is?
Okay.
Well, there are multiple definitions of a Chicago sunroof. The first one, besides the Better Call Saul reference, is someone says, placing your penis on the head of an unsuspecting person, especially a Bears fan, in a public place. I'll use it in a sentence. I totally gave Mike Ditka a Chicago sunroof. I don't think that's what Jimmy did, though.
I don't think so. If that's what he did, I'd be like, that guy's messed up in the head and he should be charged with a sex crime.
Yeah, well, he said it involved, like, destruction of property, too. So it definitely wasn't that.
What are the other ones?
All right.
Are there any reasonable ones?
Well, here's one that could be it, I suppose. The act of masturbating while standing on an overpass or tall building while attempting to ejaculate onto vehicles passing below. We're going to have to put a not safe for work warning on today's episode.
Oh, man. I don't know what he did, but nevertheless, it showed us a sign of him before his current version.
Yeah, and we also saw that in the next episode, too.
Yeah, the both episodes started with flashbacks, which was different. Both of him being particularly not the quality citizen he's trying to be in the first episode.
I don't know if Jimmy's trying to be a quality citizen as much as he's trying to not be the kind of citizen that goes to jail. I'm not sure if Jimmy ever has pure motives.
I think there's some purity to his actions, or else he wouldn't be doing them.
Okay. Well, you know what? That's true to an extent. He did call the Kettlemans.
He warned them. That's the episode, there, which is the whole plot line of that. Is.
And he used his sex robot voice, according to the other lady. I want to know the story there. This show's doing a lot of, like, in Calvin and Hobbes, it's called the Noodle Incident. Where you talk about something that sounds really, really interesting, and then you don't explain what it is. And so you leave the audience, it up to their imagination to figure out, like, what the hell is happening right now? Like, a Chicago sunroof, and now we're trying to wonder if Jimmy put his penis on a Chicago Bears head.
Or why he's using a sex robot voice, which is a paper towel tube. And something across it. I don't know what he was putting across the end of the tube, but.
So he used to date this girl, clearly, yeah?
Yeah, maybe not date. Maybe they just had a little fling going on there. No, I definitely get that from it, too. I don't know what's going on there. I don't know. I don't particularly enjoy her character anyway. She's kind of just there.
I'm interested to see what purpose she serves right now beyond person that Jimmy feels a moral responsibility to.
And she also,
which is basically.
You go ahead.
Oh, well, that's basically the only thing that she does right now is that she know there's sexual tension between her and Jimmy, and she's way too good looking to be with Bob Odenkirk. You're hilarious, Bob, but. You're old, and she's not.
She also gets on the inside of the law firm. That's
right. Yeah, so. She's our view into Hanlon, and McGill.
Yes.
Before I continue,
go ahead.
Hamlindigo Blue.
What?
Do you not remember that bit from the episode? I watched both of them today.
Okay.
So.
No, I watched. The last one last week, the third one last week, and this week's on Monday night.
Yeah, I just buy them from Xbox.
Okay.
I'm doing my best to not ever pirate anymore, because I have a big boy job.
What happened to your Hulu account? Why can't you just watch it?
I have Wait, you can stream. You can't stream Better Call Saul on Hulu.
I can watch it on demand on my cable box. So why can't you stream on Hulu?
It's because Hulu doesn't have everything like that.
Oh, I mean, you can probably even
as
watch
far
Better
as I
Call
know,
Saul on the website. I bet you.
On AMC?
I bet you they do occasionally. They do put shows on AMC.
Let me see AMC.com. Let's see if AMCTV.com, my apologies, internet, auto-corrected my thing that I typed in. Full episodes. Oh, god damn it. Yeah, I totally could have. Fuck.
Well, now
oh,
you know.
Well. Now I know. I'll just connect my laptop to my television from now on.
Yep. So, what exactly do we want to talk about in these episodes? You keep throwing these, like, oh, lead the discussion. I was like, I don't know what I want to do with this discussion. This is you.
Well, I mean,
that's your skill set. I'm the reactor, okay?
Yeah, so maybe I should keep leading these conversations then. I'm trying to put my finger exactly on what the overriding theme of Better Call Saul is. Because, you know, it was apparent, like, from the pilot what Breaking Bad was about, which was, like, male pride and how shitty that is. And, you know, I mean, it was apparent in the pilot, but it became, like, more explicitly clear as the series progressed until, like, that was basically all the show was about in the last couple seasons, was like, here is, you know, all that Walter's stubbornness and ego have wrought, so to speak. But I'm trying to put my finger four episodes in and say what exactly Better Call Saul is about, because I'm really into it so far, and Jesus Christ, Jonathan Banks is fucking funny.
It is
Mike.
Really funny. Oh, Mike, yeah, he's...
When, in the fourth episode at the very beginning, when he's pulling into the parking garage Jimmy's trying to talk to him and he says, "You're not very loquacious, are you?" And Mike just kind of looks at him, just stares right through him and says, "We can't all be as blessed as you." And it's just I don't even know if Jonathan Banks is even trying to be funny, but his delivery is so deadpan. It's so good. But back to like me trying to like figure out, you know, what's the raison d'être of, you know, the reason for existing of Better Call Saul, and I'm not sure yet.
I feel it has a very similar theme as Breaking Bad, except it's going about it in a different manner.
Yeah, it's definitely about, perhaps more than pride, it's about ambition.
Yeah, because Jimmy has a lot more ambition than Walter ever did.
Right. Well, eventually Walter said, "I'm not in the money-making business, I'm in the empire business." So, I think Walter did have more ambition than he said, although, I don't know.
And I think that the difference between particularly Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad is the shallowness of Jimmy.
Yeah, I mean, Jimmy for sure is not as smart as Walter. No, although, he's pretty clever in his own way.
Oh, yeah. The scam he did at the fourth episode with the billboard. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that was great.
Wait, did the guy fall on purpose?
Yeah, did not remember him pulling him up, and then at the end of it, they kind of like clapped hands. Like, and the guy was like, "It took you long enough."
Oh, I must have missed that. Must have been.
And that's why he was hiding it from his brother, because I think his brother knows he's a scam artist.
Right. Okay. Because the Hanlon people implied that it was
trademark infringement.
Well, not just that. They asked if that was all set up when they were watching the news.
The head honcho, yeah.
I wasn't sure. I wasn't 100% sure like what was happening.
Yeah, it was all planned. No doubt about that.
Okay, well that's interesting to know then. I thought for once Jimmy was just trying to do the right thing, and it was fortuitous. He's just the fucking most clever douchebag lawyer in existence.
Yeah, intentionally set it up to happen then when he was on camera discussing about big lawyers taking down small man. Yeah, right. You know, so he can get caught.
Right.
It.
Yeah.
Yep. He wasn't saving him. The guy had fall protection harness on. He probably would have been fine for 10-15 minutes before he started losing circulation in his legs.
Yeah, I don't mind heights, but also that would scare the hell out of me.
Yeah,
Like, I mean, I wouldn't mind being standing up there. Like, if I was strapped in and standing on the walkway, I would be okay. If I'm just dangling there, I would probably be a little anxious.
I think most people probably would be anxious, Don. Because, you know, you don't want to be using your fall protection, but it's there just in case that does happen, so.
Yeah. Like, my roommates are rock climbers.
Hmm.
And I'm they want to take me climbing with them sometime soon, and it'll have to be sometime soon. Don't laugh.
I just can't see you rock climbing.
I was the only person to finish the advanced. I wasn't the only person. I was one of only two people. It was me and Smiley, I believe. So Brian Rule. I was one of the only two Bennett Tower RAs who was able to finish the advanced rock wall at Nema Colon. I understand that that's a lot different than actual rock climbing, but I weigh literally nothing, so it's not that hard for me to hoist myself up.
You mean figuratively, literally nothing?
I mean, yeah, I don't literally weigh nothing. I have mass.
Don is just a digital voice like Samantha and her. That's all he is.
I'm a hologram. But I was the only person to do the advanced. I was one of only two people to do the advanced rock wall, and I was one of the only two people to do the advanced rope course, too. I'm more coordinated than you give me credit for. I just don't ever exercise that part of me. Ever. Nicole is the clumsy one of me and her, which is funny because she used to be a gymnast. When she was doing her gymnastic stuff, she was as graceful as can be. When she's walking across a bare floor with no shoes on, she'll fall flat on her face. It just happens. But if I went climbing with them, what they would do is I would be in the middle between the two of them, and I wouldn't actually have to do any work. So I would be down for that. Are you kidding me? That sounds fun. I would have to go outside, which is something I don't do too often.
You have to see the sun, you know.
Yeah, I would have to risk bursting into flames due to exposure to sun, direct sunlight. I'm really excited about Better Call Saul. I said this last time, but I'll say it again. This show is so much better than I thought it would be. Like, I didn't think that it was going to be bad, but I didn't think that it would be something like, oh, I definitely need to tune in each week and watch this. It would not have occurred to me that I would have been that into it immediately. I feel like Better Call Saul has its voice down way faster than it took Breaking Bad to get its voice down. And there's a reason for that. And it's the same reason that Angel got its voice down before
Buffy.
Yeah, and less time than it took Buffy to get its voice down. And that's because, at this point, Vince Gilligan ran a show for 6 years in the same way that, you know, Joss Whedon had been running a show for... Angel started during Buffy's fourth season, so he had been doing Buffy for 3 seasons before he started Angel. So he knew kind of what he wanted to make and who he wanted to be as a TV person. Although, Angel is significantly different after its first season.
Yeah, it does. It changes a lot. Yeah, and also, you know, it's easy to start a show off when you have pre-existing character that has depth already and a background and purpose.
Also true.
Just saying. And also, it's nearly the same crew that did Breaking Bad. There's like a few differences, I think, in the writing room. But other than that, everyone's the same. So you got a seasoned staff doing work they've been doing for 6 years, basically. So...
Yeah, no, I mean, that is, and it shows,
it
I guess.
Shows.
I mean, I love, like, Breaking Bad's pilot is one of the best pilots I can think of off the top of my head. It's up there with Lost's in terms of being, like, just, you know, the perfect introduction to the show that you're about to watch. that vision of Walter in his underwear frantically talking into a camera sets the tone for the entire series, which is, hey, here's this really smart guy who keeps getting himself in over his head.
There's something I noticed too, is in Breaking Bad, there's lots of close-ups of Walter.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've talked about this before, but Breaking Bad is one of the most cinematically... How do I say this? It's one of the most cinematic-looking TV shows ever.
I mean, it was definitely ambitious in how it was run. I mean, there's some great episodes of Breaking Bad, like...
I'm just talking about the way that it looks. You know? And nothing else on TV in 2000, whatever year Breaking Bad started, nothing else on TV looked like Breaking Bad. You know, nothing was taking all of the experiments with camera angles and stuff. So, excuse me. I'm definitely not surprised that the close-up, which is one of the most cinematic of camera angles, was prevalent on the series.
But that's something you don't see in Better Call Saul.
Well, I think the close-up was serving the purpose of reminding us all of how much Walter means to Walter.
And I think it's also an ego thing. I think Walter meaning Walter, yeah, I think... Walter always had a big ego, and those close-ups help, you know, make the audience feel that ego as well. And I think in Better Call Saul, Saul doesn't have a big ego. He wants to have a big ego. He thinks he's big, but he's not big. Because there's lots of times where Saul just seems small.
Yeah, for sure. And you don't get that too much with Walter. As the series progresses, he becomes more and more of this imposing figure.
Mm-hmm.
When the show begins, he's kind of this sad, emasculated kiss-ass at both his high school and in his marriage and at the car, particularly at the car wash. But by the end of the show, he's just a bully, and he's shot differently because of that. I wouldn't be surprised if at the beginning of Breaking Bad, Walter was shot primarily from the, like, at face level. And then towards the end of the show, he started being shot more and more from lower angles, because villains are shot at lower angles. That's like one of the unspoken rules of cinematography that people unconsciously absorb. That if somebody is shot at this like kind of low angle, it makes them look really tall and really intimidating, because you're trying to make them look like a bad guy. It's like when people do close-ups when somebody realizes something. That's... Nothing is happening on that actor's face that's letting you know for sure that they've just realized something. You have just learned from, you know, a century now of filmmaking that that's what that technique means. So, an interesting conversation that we should have someday, although I don't know where it would fit into the regular conventions of the podcast, is this idea that... I mean, it's not an idea, it's a fact. That consumers of cinema... have, without knowing it, they know what really abstract shot and editing decisions mean, although they would never be able to tell you what it meant if you asked them. But if you were to show them in a film, you'd be like, oh, yeah, he's realized. If you were to show the average person a slow zoom in on somebody, or a slow dolly in, either way, most people don't use zooms anymore. It's all about dollies, because zooms look differently than dollies. That's another conversation for another day. But if you were to do, you know, ask the average person, hey, what does it mean usually when a filmmaker does a slow dolly zoom in on a performer's face? They would never say, oh, it's because he realizes something. But if you were to show somebody reading a document, and then you slowly zoomed in on their face, and you never saw the document, and there wasn't honestly that much change in the actor's face, most people would be like, oh, there's something important in this document. It's an interesting phenomena. And there's this thing called the Kuleshov effect, which is if you combine the same basically expressionless face with various images. Like, let's say you put an expressionless face next to a dead child. I mean, like, you had a shot of an expressionless face, and then you edited in after that a shot of, like, a tombstone or something. The average person would say that the person that whose expressionless face they saw, they would say he's sad. And if you then showed, you know, another person that same expressionless face and then cut to food, they would say that person was hungry. That was something a Soviet filmmaker, particularly, I think he was an editor, realized, which was like, oh, there's power in the way that we intentionally edit images together. And so that phenomena was, I don't know what the word I'm looking for here is. That's where that phenomenon began. I don't know why I was having trouble coming up with the word began.
Okay, I didn't know where you were trying to go with that statement, so I couldn't help you.
Yeah, sorry. We're 50 minutes into the podcast, so we're going to go ahead and say, people, keep watching Better Call Saul. I mean, that's really all I can say at this point. It's good. We're going to be talking about it for the entire season until Game of Thrones starts.
Which we got a while before that. We got a little over a month before games start, I think, right? A month and a half almost, actually. I think it starts like middle of April.
When is the last episode? The final episode ends on April 6th.
Game of Thrones. So it's like.
No, I know, I know, I know. So we'll be talking about them simultaneously then for a couple weeks then.
We can rotate back and forth. We usually never talk about TVs back to back, really. Occasionally we do, but not often.
Yeah, I mean, we did it sometimes for Game of Thrones, and we definitely did it a couple times for True Detective, but for the most part, we tried not to do that. Yeah. Well, we're going to move on to the secret sauce. And Trev, how are you enjoying your new 3DS?
Well, be honest with you, I haven't had that much time to play it. I got on Friday, and I've been super busy lately. So, and I could have played it probably on Sunday a lot, but I decided to take some naps instead.
Well, hey, nothing wrong with I took a nap today, so it's okay.
Okay. I'm enjoying it. It's definitely different. I haven't bought a Nintendo portable gaming device since. Oh,
the
man.
The DS?
Maybe the original DS. Maybe. Yeah, I think maybe the original DS. I think I had it. That was a while ago, though. Oof. I don't even know where that is at this point. It could probably be lost in some move I've had, so. Yeah, it's definitely bigger. The controls are not as convenient as I thought they would be at first. I feel like the bumpers are too close to the edge because I'm always hitting them.
I'm always hitting the volume button on my 3DS.
Yeah, because that's right there too. Right, where you put your thumbs when you like holding it. If you want using your thumbs to do something else.
Yeah, I always hit it with the I hit it with the bone where your whatever the joint is. Where your index finger connects back to your palm. I always accidentally move it up. I don't know what it's like. I don't know where it's positioned on the regular on the new 3DS, but on the old 3DS XL, which is the one that I have, although I'm thinking about trading it in for the new one, it's definitely like right there. And anytime I have to do anything with the left bumper, I always hit it. Yeah. Or if I'm moving up from the, it particularly happens if I'm moving up from the circle pad to the directional buttons.
Moving
like
up? You said moving up, so the joystick is on the bottom for you?
Or moving down or moving up, either way, I'm not sure.
Okay, well, I mean, it makes a difference, because I'm like, hey, what? Okay. Yeah, because the joystick on the top on the left side for me, and then the D-pad below that. And on the right side, I have the four buttons, the C-stick, and the select and start.
Yeah, because I don't ever accidentally hit the, for example, I never accidentally hit the Wi-Fi button. Like, I don't hit the thing that, like, turns Wi-Fi on and off when I'm with my right hand. But I always hit the volume button with my left hand. So, I'm constantly, like, having to turn down fucking Pokemon. Although I beat that a while ago, so I haven't played it. I'm playing Persona Q now. Which, in it, you have to actively map dungeons yourself, which is interesting. Hmm. It's very old-school tabletop D&D in that regard.
That is interesting.
Huh. So you aren't really sure what's happening in Monster Hunter right now, and I'm going to go ahead and tell you, don't go into that game expecting that game to have a good story, because it's not going to. I haven't played it, but people don't play Monster Hunter games for the story. It's kind of a mechanical thing.
That's what I figured, which is not selling me. I've always been a story player. Stories usually sell me first and foremost, and then gameplay is next, and a button smasher is okay occasionally. I haven't played the Monster Hunter enough right now to really understand what's happening or how to get things done. I've gone on a few quests, and they're pretty easy quests, and I discovered in my last quest I can't pick up too many things, or I get really bogged down and I can't run. I was like, well, that's a thing.
Yeah, that game has a lot of complex interlocking mechanics. It's really that game is really about making sure you're as prepared as possible for the big hunts.
Yeah,
it's about like
I haven't done a big hunt yet, so that's
right. That's where the meat of the game is. It's about exploring like the massive environments that the game features and engaging in hunts against enormous monsters and figuring out the best strategies to deal with them. So, I am generally a story guy too when it comes to games. Although I've found that the stories in most video games are terrible. Like, even, like, the ones that I like. Like old-school Japanese RPGs. There's a lot of really interesting world-building going on in those games, but then the narratives are all really trope-driven and very clichéd and kind of absurd and ridiculous. As I've gotten older, I've become much more appreciative of games that do a mechanical thing really well. Like Diablo 3, for example, is one of the most mechanically pure experiences I've ever played. Nobody plays that fucking game for the story because it's stupid. Or at least that was my experience with the story of Diablo 3, having not played 1 or 2. I thought it was just all sorts of nonsense. But that was okay because the story didn't distract from what that game was really about, which was killing everything in sight and getting sweet new loot. I mean, that's the core, you know, feedback loop of Diablo. You click on things and they die, and occasionally that's really it. You get some cool new helmet to wear that makes you look badass as fuck. And Monhan is like that too. I think it's also it's like crafting driven. It's about, you know, the quests that you go on to kill all these monsters give you materials to make, you know, better armor and weapons, which then allow you to kill bigger things.
Yeah,
that's basically what Monster Hunter boils down to.
That's what I'm determining so far, but I haven't really had an opportunity to do any crafting or gaining a material. I'm still learning the basic mechanics of going on a hunt, you know?
Right, so that's for sure. So maybe we'll bring this all up again next week.
Yeah.
Once you've had a little more time to play it.
Well, assume I do. And plus, I feel like Monster Hunter is designed to be a social game too. Like, you're supposed to be playing with other people.
It is. It's definitely very co-op driven. I mean, what the fuck do I know? I've never played it, but everything that I've read about it, I feel like I have some authority on these issues. I am a professional video game journalist after all. Yeah, but it is supposed to be a very social-driven experience. I've been playing Dragon Age Inquisition, which is there's nobody better than BioWare at character-driven video game storytelling. Just there never has. There's never been anybody better than them. I don't know if there ever will be anybody better than them, except for maybe the team that made Gone Home, which has been my favorite video game of the 2010s so far. But that game's enormous. I've put 13 hours into it, and I'm like level 6.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, this is the team that made like Baldur's Gate and stuff.
Still, only level 6.
Yeah, Baldur's Gate. Yeah, and I haven't left the first real zone. I probably could have left that zone, but I haven't yet. Like, I've done 13 hours worth of quests in the first game zone, and there's still a shit ton more to do.
Yeah, you're one of those people that just has to do all the quests. Like, oh, I want to do this quest.
I kind of do. If there's something on the map, it's weird. I don't care about collectibles ever in games unless they're on my map. If they're on my map, I am physiologically compelled to collect every single one of them.
He's like, I have to clean my map. Gotta get everything off my
map. I do. I have to, like, just... I don't need these little things, you know, shining and saying, hey, come find me. But It's enormous. The world is beautiful. The character models aren't that great looking, but this world that they've created is really striking. BioWare can make the most seemingly unimportant background characters have more of a backstory and, you know, understandable motivations than the average, you know, main character from your, you know, AAA first-person shooter. Like, BioWare is just so good at making you care about the people in their games. And that's the key to caring about a game in general, is if you care about the person you're playing as. And BioWare is really, really good at that. So if any of our listeners are looking for a fun new game to play, that's good. I've also been playing Assassin's Creed Black Flag, which is also has an extraordinarily large world, and it's fun as fuck to play, but I couldn't care less about the story or the main character. So, I just think the storytelling in the Assassin's Creed games has just gotten worse since Brotherhood, probably.
Well, I think that's because they keep pushing them out, like, every year.
Yeah, no, yearly releases are a major problem.
I was like, and this topic, I don't think Assassin's Creed is a good franchise for doing that. Call of Duty is, because Call of Duty is all about just new maps and new gadgets. I think, because he has such a good story in, like, Assassin's Creed 2 and then Brotherhood.
Yeah, I loved 2 and 2. I mean, Brotherhood's my favorite in the franchise, I think. Although 2, I like 2 a lot for sentimental reasons because of Florence and Venice and everything.
Yeah.
But I think Brotherhood was the culmination of everything that they were trying to do with that series. And then from that point forward, it just felt like we have to make this, but we're not going to put the effort into making it as memorable and exciting as it could be. And so, like, you know, I hated the story and I didn't say I hated it. It was just completely forgettable. The story in Assassin's Creed Revelations was totally forgettable. It played fun minus the terrible tower defense stuff. But, you know, it was a good game. But, you know, when you release the same good game every year with just basically just really minor additions to things, it really ruins the fun of it. Like, I don't want to pay $60 every year just because you know, added ship battles to your game. The ship battles were my least favorite part of Assassin's Creed 3, so...
Yeah, and if they would have made it, like, every other year, they probably would have been fine.
Yeah, no, for sure. And then, you know, Assassin's Creed Unity, which was the one set during the French Revolution that just came out last year, it was released with just a litany of bugs. It was embarrassed. I would have been embarrassed to work at Ubisoft had I been one of the people behind the release of that game, because it was in such a disgraceful state. So, you know, there's a... I think big game developers are learning that, hey, you know, there's a price to releasing games every fucking year. Rockstar doesn't do that. You know how many years it was between Grand Theft Auto 4 and Grand Theft Auto 5? I'm going to look it up right now.
My guess is 3.
A lot more than that. Grand Theft Auto 4 came out my freshman year of college. It was 5 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Hey, or wait, no, did that...
Wait, what?
Yeah, no, 5 years, 5 years.
Okay.
So, 5 years between what is arguably the biggest franchise in video games of the last two generations in terms of, you know, massive sales. 5 years between releases, and they sold a fucking bajillion copies of it. Whereas, all the Call of Duty games sell a bunch, but the reviews for that franchise have steadily been going down year after year after year until this most recent one, Advanced Warfare, because it was a really sort of drastic reinvention of the series. Drastic in the sense that it became kind of sci-fi and futuristic. It was their attempt to kind of capitalize on Titanfall, which I really want to play, and I have an Xbox One now, so I can, I suppose. But yeah, so people, yearly releases are bad. That was the theme of the secret sauce, unintentionally. Not really. There was no theme this week or last week. I'm going to try not to say
theme. There was a theme last week. There was no theme this week.
I mean, there was the theme last week was that there wasn't a theme.
Exactly.
Fair enough, I suppose. Well, on that note, next week, Trevor, I apologize in advance for this. Not because it's a bad film. I've watched this one recently, so I know for a fact that it's great. It's the saddest film that we've watched for the podcast so far.
Okay.
Mentally prepare yourself.
Okay.
It's one of those films that's like so sad that it doesn't make you cry. It makes you feel dead inside. It's too sad to cry in. So you've been warned. So we're watching Boys Don't Cry, the true story of the murder of transgender man Brandon Tina, which won an Academy Award for Best Actress for Hilary Swank, who was basically an unknown actress at that point in her career. She had been living in a van before she shot that film. With her, I think her and her mother moved to Hollywood, and she... Well, this is a conversation for next week.
Yeah.
For the secret sauce, I have no idea, unless we talk about Better Call Saul again. That's fine. We'll talk about Better Call Saul again.
I was trying to think if there's something relevant this weekend, but I don't think there is. No.
No, not unless we want to go see Jupiter Ascending, and I don't want to see Jupiter Ascending. I do want to see Jupiter Ascending. I just don't want to pay to see it in theaters.
I don't blame you. There's nothing in the theaters. I think the only thing I thought about maybe watching was the King's Men, because I heard decent things about it for what it was trying to do, so...
Yeah, I mean, I like Colin Farrell, but that's also another one that I don't want to pay to see in theaters.
Yeah.
Did I say Farrell?
You did.
God damn it. It's not like I don't know the difference between
There's
them.
There's a huge difference between those two.
Yeah, Colin Firth is like one of my favorite actors. His performance in A Single Man won my gravy boat for last year. So, Colin Farrell will be in True Detective, though.
That's true.
Yeah. So that's that. And then for the secret sauce, we'll figure it out. Probably a Monster Hunter conversation, though, if Trevor has time to play more of it. And on that note, Trevor, see us out.
You can always follow us on Twitter at SauceSpective. You can also like us on Facebook, where you can also communicate that way with us. And you can find us on iTunes. Just search the SauceSpective, and we'll be the only one. Where you can also rate us and review us, which helps people find us and also helps us figure out what we're doing right and wrong. Feedback is awesome, people. And also, as always, you can always check out the website, thesauceperspective.com, where you can find other editorials and other podcasts on the Sauce Perspective Empire. and
the Sauce Perspective Empire. We are all, like Walter White, we're also in the Empire business, apparently. I didn't get that memo. I thought we were in the two people with too much free time on their hands and their bedrooms business, but we're apparently we're emperors now. I'm Emperor Don. This is Emperor Trevor. And we'll see you next week.
Right.